If you've just been woken from sleep, or if you have just come out of surgery, or if you've had your bell rung, then there is something that's true of you, and that is that you have a palpable sense of being disoriented, right? You don't know where you are, which A is up, who you are, what area you're in, and therefore at that moment it would be unwise of me to hand you a power tool or put you behind the wheel of a car, right? You are insensible to the reality of such things because you are disoriented to the way things are. One commentator on the book of Proverbs says that Proverbs is out to tell us the way things are in the world, the nature of reality, and therefore wisdom is all about becoming oriented to that reality. Foolhardiness, foolishness, is actually living in a state of perpetual disorientation to the way things are, of trying to live in ways that are not congruous or congruent with the whole nature of existence. And it's the effort of those who wrote the Proverbs and compiled the Proverbs to instill in all of us, what does it mean to live here? What does it mean to exist in this moment in the way things are? We've been in a series on the Proverbs ever since the turn of the year. We continue in that series today. Today, though, we're going to focus on the theme of what it means to be faithful, of what it means to be diligent. And as I said at the beginning of the service this morning, there is nothing that lives and breathes and lasts and has been fashioned and fabricated in a way that is beautiful to us that wasn't applied, didn't come to reality without diligence being applied in some form or fashion. That if you want to understand the way things are, then you need to understand that everything that you might want to give yourself to will require diligence, period. We're going to consider that theme, but we're going to kind of do it in an unorthodox way. Because sometimes the way you best learn a virtue is by studying the vice that corresponds to it. And so we're going to consider mostly a parable of the antithesis of diligence, which the Proverbs calls sluggardliness. Great word. Probably not a word that you use this week, but a word that you are perhaps all too familiar with. Some of you in this room may think, that doesn't apply to me. I'm not worried. And others of you in this room may think, yeah, that's me, and I don't know how to get out. The Proverbs has something to say to us today, and in so doing, we're going to learn three things about diligence, even though it's through its antithesis. We're going to see diligence dramatized. We're going to see diligence realized. And we're going to find out how can diligence be galvanized in us, how it can be inspired in us. We're going to read several texts from the Proverbs. We're going to focus on one in particular, one passage. So would you stand as we read from the Proverbs on diligence and sluggardliness? Readings from the Proverbs, starting in chapter 6. Go to the ant, O sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief, officer, or ruler, she prepares her bread in summer and gathers her food in harvest. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? Like vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is the sluggard to those who send him. The sluggard does not plow in the autumn. He will seek at harvest and have nothing. The desire of the sluggard kills him, for his hands refuse to labor. I passed by the field of a sluggard, by the vineyard of a man lacking sense, and behold, it was all overgrown with thorns. The ground was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. And then I saw and considered it. I looked and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber, and want like an armed man. The sluggard says, there's a lion in the road, there's a lion in the streets. As a door turns on its hinges, so does a sluggard on his bed. The sluggard buries his hand in the dish, it wears him out to bring it back to his mouth. The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly. Whoever works his land will have plenty of bread, but he who follows worthless pursuits will have plenty of poverty. Many a man proclaims his own steadfast love, but a faithful man who can find? This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. We heard several texts in succession there. I actually want us to focus our attention to the one that reads more like a parable, the one about the man passing by the vineyard of a sluggard. it's different from perhaps some of the other texts that we've considered in previous weeks, and different from some of the other texts even here in this series of texts, in that it's told in a narrative style. It gives you a story. And this story, as parables are wont to do, leads to a point. It's compact, it's succinct, and like any good novel, the imagery and the storyline accentuates the wisdom it offers. And in keeping with the Proverbs context of something like an intimate discussion between a parent and a child, it tells the story in first person, and then it directs its point to you who are the listener. Listen again in Proverbs chapter 24, verse 30. I passed by the field of the sluggard, the vineyard of a man lacking sense. Two things to note just in that first phrase. One, our storyteller is speaking of walking by a field, which she specifies as a vineyard. And to us, that's pretty unremarkable because not many of us are farmers, and because we have no real concept of what it means to be dependent on the land. You and I can pop down to Tom Thumb. We can drop into Sprouts, which our family affectionately knows is where our money sprouts wings. And you can pick up whatever you want whenever you want to. That's just the nature of modern life. I was on vacation once in the panhandle of Texas, and you drive by row after row after row of cornfields, and it's pretty unremarkable if you're me or if you're you. Because yes, people might get corn on the cob from that very field, but if drought hits that land and that crop goes bad, Tom Thumb will just find some other supplier. It's just the way things are. The significance of the land as I drove by it was negligible to me. That kind of nonchalant attitude towards land would have been foreign to an Israelite. Darn right sacrilegious in some sense, perhaps. The land on which this vineyard had been planted would have meant the very survival of the people who owned it. If drought hits, they die unless they find some other land to grow or produce or graze their livestock. That's one reason why the scripture takes such pains to mention times of famine. Famine matters in an arable community like that. Famines were devastating to families. If the land, therefore, is survival, it's also their source of stability. It was a refuge, a home base. It was a place for cultivation, both of food and of family. It's that same significance that the land represents when we consider all of the conflagrations going on in the Middle East right now. Land is what's at the center of the fight. Whose is it? Who shall benefit from it? Who lays claim to it? People are fighting and dying over land because of what it supplies to those who have it. It was survival. It was stability. But land was also one other thing in the mind of an Israelite. It was a gift. You cannot read the Old Testament without noticing how the land for the Israelites was itself a gift from God who was in covenant with them. The reason I post on the front of your bulletin the text from Deuteronomy 6 is to impress upon you how this land was everything. Listen to that text again on the front of your bulletin. The Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, to give you, with great and good cities that you did not build, houses full of all good things that you did not fill, cisterns that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees you did not plant. This land, where this proverbial field would have been, where this vineyard could be planted, was a gift. Yes, they might tend it and reap from it, but they can't take credit for having it. It had been entrusted to them. It was a gift. And that's why the larger setting of this field the storyteller is talking about is amplifying the significance of the other thing to note in this verse. This field was the field of a sluggard. Now, that's not a word, as I said at the top, that we use very often. In fact, you don't probably find it used outside the Proverbs. You and I might substitute the word slouch for it. The rest of the Proverbs is going to profile the number of ways in which a sluggard operates. In 6:9, it says, "How long will you lie there, O sluggard? It's one who is slow to do what needs to be done." A sluggard is one whose preference for delay makes him a frustration to everybody around him. And that's why it says in chapter 10, 26, like vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is a sluggard to those who send him. A slouch is somebody who is too obtuse to do the simple, common sense thing, and in the end, he compromises himself. That's why it says in 24, the sluggard does not plow in the autumn, and he will seek at harvest and have nothing. But for all of the inertia that you might say is inherent to a sluggard, the sluggard is not a pushover. He's actually firm in his conviction to act. And that's why it says towards the end of our series of text there, it says in 26:16, the sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly. He's absolutely assured that what he is doing is the right thing to do. That's the profile of a sluggard. And in our text, you see the heart of a sluggard indicated by the vineyard. Verse 31, behold, it was all overgrown with thorns, the ground was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. The vineyard is a mess. But the storyteller knows it's a sluggard's vineyard because of what we know about vineyards. They don't deteriorate overnight. Thorns and nettles don't overtake anything in short order. The wall that would have been built around that vineyard by piling stones around the perimeter, it would not have been demolished quickly. There were no backhoes to accidentally back into a wall. A stone or two might have fallen at times, but it would have taken prolonged neglect of its condition for there to be a breach in the wall so that any beast or scavenger might make off with whatever's on that vine. So the picture on the front of your bulletin, which is apt and perfect, that picture, that scene, that didn't happen in an instant. It took a good long while. And that's why the storyteller knows it's a sluggard's vineyard. All that would have taken to hold back the thorn and the nettle infestation was a little daily maintenance of pruning. All he would have to have done to keep his wall from being demolished was to replace a few stones here and there that might have fallen on that day or week. And so our storyteller stops and considers the significance of the sight. The scene already says a lot about the owner. He went to the trouble of planting it. He went to the trouble of building the wall around it, but he didn't see fit to tend it. And the longer the storyteller ponders the scene, the more he derives a serviceable truth from it, a truth that identifies both the nature of the owner and the consequences of his action. Look in verse 32. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber and want like an armed man. The field owner preferred rest to work. Anything but applying himself to responsibility. Gradually, slowly, subtly, maybe even imperceptibly, he drifted from attending to what was needed. And then in a flash, ruin. Loss. Poverty. He saw it coming, and yet he didn't see it coming. He planted the field to provide. He neglected that field, and suddenly his neglect cost him. That's the story of the proverb. That's what happened. And you can see it. And two brief points come from that reality. One is this: neglect rarely feels like neglect to the one who's neglecting. This owner nickeled and dimed away his time and attention. It never felt like a sizable investment of energy away from the care of a field. It was just a little this. It was just a little that. There was no concerted effort to neglect. But the imperceptible nature of neglect notwithstanding, the consequences of that neglect are clearly ruinous. It left him with nothing to live on. His refusal to work and take responsibility for himself had actually now created more work for himself. And so if you wanted to distill the whole message of this little parable, it's this: no neglect goes unrequited. Frightening thought, right? No neglect goes unrequited. Now, in a moment like this, some of you might be thinking, great, nice story, important point. When do we eat? I'm not a farmer. I'm not concerned about neglecting my garden. I really can go to Tom Thumb. It's going to be okay. But even if you're broadening the scope of its ethic beyond an agricultural setting, let's just say that you're seeing how it may apply to any matter of responsibility. You might be thinking, hey, I have a home, my mortgage is paid, I do my job, I'm on top of my cholesterol, my retirement account is fine, my carbon footprint is within acceptable parameters. This story is not my problem, I'm not a slouch. To which I would say to any of you who might be thinking that, you don't have to be a slouch to be a sluggard. Okay, nice paradox. What do I mean? To be a sluggard, you just have to make peripheral things central and central things peripheral. And then you might not be a slouch about some things, but you can be a slouch about the important things. The sluggard is just someone who makes disengagement his priority over engagement. Sleep wins out over survival. He made peripheral things central. Friends, that's our lifelong challenge, right? Maybe not learning to value survival over sleep, but learning not to make too much of unimportant things or just less important things. We inevitably end up neglecting something because we get wrapped around a pull about something that's less important. We know, therefore, sluggardly in that sense. We're all intimately acquainted with it. We all have to recalibrate and reset our moment from time to time because we realize I have become a slouch about things that are central. So to be a sluggard just means to make peripheral things central. But secondly, to be a sluggard, you just have to forget that everything that you have is a gift. The land upon which he planted his vineyard was a gift. The capacity to plant and harvest is something that he can't control. He's at the mercy, the beneficence of the seed and the fruit, and yet all of that is a gift. The neglect of it is to forget its nature. Now, would anyone deny that that's our problem? That what we have, we take for granted. That we become too quickly discontented with what we have, or that we operate on a hollow feeling that drives us to accrue all the more, never being satisfied with what we already have. We succumb to those things because we don't believe that what we have is a gift. And in that sense, we know what it means to be a sluggard. Now, to get back to our original theme of diligence, to be diligent is to be attentive to what's central. To be diligent is to see that what you have is a gift, as something that's been entrusted to your care. And that applies to everything. And so that's diligence, or rather its antithesis, dramatized in pretty sharp relief. How does it work, though, in every other domain of existence that we might be a part of? Because, as I said, very few of you in this room, if any of you, are farmers. How does it apply? The implications of a text on neglect go far broader and deeper than just to your physical or financial condition. Let me apply it, or let me see how it's realized in a couple of domains that you're maybe more familiar with. Can you see how the danger of neglect might apply to you if you're married? I have mentioned to you in passing before a counselor by the name of Dan Allender, worthy, full of great wisdom and insight, full of very reputable understanding of how marriages work. In one of his books on marriage, he talks about the three primary violations of marriage. Divorce and abuse are two of the obvious ones. But the third one is more subtle, but just as devastating, and he calls that the violation of indifference. It's when all matters of significance in a marriage are avoided. They're tiptoed around. They're put to the margins. And when the issues that create tension go unaddressed, you've committed the violation of indifference. What becomes central in the marriage is the avoidance of conflict, and what becomes peripheral is the response to it. They try to maintain a kind of intimacy in that relationship by stepping around conflict or tension instead of seeing the path through the conflict as the path to intimacy. And the thorns and nettles of unresolved tension begin to infest the marriage, not because you're a couch potato doing nothing. You might be some of the busiest people in the city. But you allow those peripheral things that keep you busy become central while the central things become peripheral. And that makes you a sluggard. That makes me a sluggard. And the tension has to go somewhere. And if you got kids, Kids pick up on that, Allender argues. And they learn to value peace at the expense of honesty. They learn not to rock the boat if they see their parents always trying to keep a brave and cool-hearted face on things. They learn that, and it takes a long time to unlearn it. You see how neglect goes there? It can. When's the last time you took the time to ask about the quality of your relationship? When's the last time you addressed what might be a theme of tension within the marriage? Discussing those questions is the beginning of diligence being realized. If the way to stave off the ruin of neglect is by a little regular attention, then how would it be if you applied a little attention this week to your marriage? The thorns and nettles will grow. The wall will fall down without a little diligence. What's true of marriages is also true of the spiritual vitality of families. Christian Smith is a sociologist at Notre Dame. He's the author of several books in the last couple of years, both about the spiritual lives of teenagers and of children and of young adults. And his observations are these. Most kids, upon leaving home, discard any devotion to faith of their childhood. Why? As he acknowledges, the sovereign grace of God is still true and therefore doesn't talk about the spiritual lives of our children in a purely scientific formulaic terms, but he does insist that the single most common characteristic of adolescents who continued in their own spiritual formation upon leaving home was that their parents and a few other close adults took an interest in those kids' formation. They taught them the basic tenets of the faith. In Reformed tradition, we call that catechizing. They instructed them in the basic contours of the spiritual life, how to read a Bible, what it is to pray, how our faith shapes our priorities. Parents invited their children to express their questions and their doubts about spiritual matters. That mattered. They didn't outsource them to somebody else. They might have stumbled through that responsibility pretty awkwardly, but they did so prayerfully and tearfully. They saw useful and helpful activities like Sunday school and VBS as supplements to their own kids' spiritual lives, but not a substitute for their own investment. And so from that analysis, we infer this. To back off from your kids in spiritual formation is in some sense to sit back and watch the thorns and nettles grow. Now look, I'm a Calvinist. I believe it's the grace of God that calls young people to himself in spite of their parents sometimes. But if you knew that the Lord uses your own feeble diligence in such matters to accomplish that goodness for your children, why wouldn't you want to be a part of that? I'm preaching to myself. Diligence applies to marriages. Diligence applies to families. But look, you don't have to be married. You don't have to have kids to realize how this applies to every domain of your existence. Anything that you're associated with or related to is an invitation to diligence, and it also provides a temptation to negligence. Jobs, your friends, your body, the upkeep of your home, your space, they all call for diligence to honor their need for cultivation and stewardship. And in every single one of those domains, none of us suddenly chooses to neglect them. We just drift. A little this, a little that, a little folding of the hands to some other alluring thing. The drift toward negligence in this broader sense is so much a part of us. And so the question that remains and stares us in the face is this. What hope have we of avoiding the kinds of negligence that we're so prone to? How will diligence ever be realized in us? You can read these texts every day for the rest of your life, but the fear of loss cannot be what mainly motivates you to diligence. So what's going to galvanize diligence in you? I'll tell you one way that won't work. Fear won't do it. I read an article this week. I haven't seen the film Whiplash. It's about a student musician who's a drummer, and his mentor is a guy that just berates him, belittles him, throws chairs, screams at him, calls him worthless in order to motivate excellence. And you know what? It works. The guy becomes a better drummer. And in this article, they were comparing that phenomenon to the two coaches who led the two teams that played in the National Collegiate Football Championship. One coach, on principle, said that neither he nor anyone of his coaching staff would ever scream, berate, or belittle any of his players in order to motivate them to excellence. The other coach's team, or the other team's coach, didn't have that principle. Now, who won? Ohio State did. But which coach elected not to scream? It was Oregon's. And so people look at that phenomenon and go, wait a minute. Maybe there is something to really screaming and making you frightened about being nothing or nobody if you're not diligent. But upon reflection and analysis, people have discovered that if you are the mentee of someone that is entirely screaming at you, berating you, belittling you, at some point you begin to tune that out. You stop listening. It may have motivated you for a moment, but not forever. And what it surely did not do, according to this article, it never instilled love in the ones that were being mentored. If I just scream at you, you're a fool if you're not diligent. It does not apply. And you may wonder, well, wait a minute, this language is pretty sharp about being fools and sluggards, but remember the context in which the Proverbs are shared. It's a parent to a child. It's a father and mother to their boy or their girl in the context of love. What will galvanize diligence in you? Go back to one little plot device in the parable, the thorns, for just a moment. The first time you and I ever heard the word thorns in the Bible, it's in Genesis chapter 3. When a curse falls upon the garden, and those things are thorns, they push against the labors and fruitfulness. It turns work into toilsome labor, where the sweat now comes from your brow because there are so many things marshaled against you to keep you from fulfilling what you're out to do. Why do the thorns emerge? Out of the first and most fundamental transgression against God. And what was that transgression? To live independently of Him. To say to the Lord, I got this and I don't need your help and I'd rather you just go away. To think ourselves capable of living well outside His will. That's the condition, brothers and sisters, that you and I are born into and live with and materialize and incarnate from our earliest days. The sluggard and all his interest in doing everything peripheral is born of that twisted belief that he knows better, and we know that too. We're living out the reality of the truth of the garden, where the thorns were. The thorns in Genesis 3 are the fruit of the curse. The thorns in Proverbs chapter 24, they are what choke out the fruitfulness of the vineyard due to neglect of the sluggard. But there's one other place that thorns emerge. The thorns become the crown of a king. Jesus Christ wears a crown of thorns. And in wearing that crown for our sin, including the sin of our neglect, we are forgiven in Him. The Father submits His own Son to neglect, our neglect. He allows Him to be robbed of His life so that we might become enriched in the grace of God. There is an echo of the fall, but there is also an echo of the cross in the field of the sluggard. Our hope of not being overrun by thorns, of not succumbing to the pull of negligence, is to fix our eyes on the one who suffered the thorns to push back against the curse of the thorns. See, we said earlier that the sluggard, to be a sluggard, you just had to do two things. You had to make peripheral things central. To look at Jesus is to know what's central, and He establishes what's central. He died that men might be reconciled to Him. He lived that righteousness might come to fruition upon the whole earth. The more you see what's central to Him, and the more He works what's central into your heart by His Spirit, the less likely you are to neglect what's central. And the other thing that makes you a sluggard is to forget that all you have is a gift, that apart from Him, I have nothing. And sure enough, that in Him, He shows us that every triumph is just a taste of what's to come. He's our gift. How does it apply? Brothers and sisters, I'm 43. And I have reached an age where I am now, for the first time, reflecting upon my past and seeing choices that I have made and realizing the consequences of several of those choices, some of which I regret. Habits that I formed from a very early moment that now are things I'm trying to escape. Things that I long to see diligence applied in my life. Now, Jonathan Edwards did a sermon on Ephesians 5, and he said, when you're young, the devil whispers in your ear and says, you got all the time in the world. Whatever you want to do, do it. And then when you're old, he whispers in your ear, boy, you wasted a lot of time. Too bad for you. Kids, you do have a lot of time, Lord willing. But you must make the most of every opportunity with all the diligence that you have. You older folk like me, maybe you have wasted a lot of time and are full of regrets. But I dare say, if you think Jesus is going to whisper in your ears, you fool, you wasted so much time, I'm done with you. That's not the Jesus I know. And it's not the gospel I know. The gospel that galvanizes diligence in you that says, oh, yes, it may be sorrowful to have realized of habits that you formed that now are something that you're out to escape. But brothers and sisters, it is his love that reminds you he's worthy of diligence. But his love will never end. He will never forsake you. If you want diligence to be galvanized in you from whatever time you have left, whether it's 60 years or 6 years, you have to look at the cross. Because in that love, there is diligence to be found. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.